Imagine a profession where the core requirement for success is, well, making yourself profoundly vulnerable.
Right.
Your daily schedule, your face, your correct cell phone number, and your exact physical location are just, they're broadcast to the public domain at any given hour.
Yeah, and your primary duty is meeting complete strangers.
Exactly. Completely alone, usually in empty, isolated buildings. You're essentially handing out a public roadmap to your daily whereabouts.
It honestly reads like the setup for a suspense thriller. I mean, it's a scenario that any corporate security professional or executive protection detail would advise you to avoid at all costs. The risk exposure is just massive.
But it's not a movie. It's not a thought experiment. It's literally just a Tuesday for a commercial real estate agent.
Yeah.
And our mission for today's deep dive is to explore this chilling vulnerability in the business world.
Yes.
We're doing that by reviewing the private case files of Priyanshu Uttathakur,
who goes by Pri in the industry.
Right. And Pri is the lead investigative reporter behind the series The Midnight Ledger,
which is such an incredible resource because he meticulously tracks these kinds of systemic vulnerabilities. And what makes his reporting so vital here is his perspective.
He's not just a journalist at a desk reading police blotters.
Exactly. Pri is an investment advisor. He's a fellow realtor. He handles commercial properties and boutique hotel real estate. He navigates these exact same physical risks on the ground every single day.
So we're looking at this through the lens of a practitioner. In this specific report from the Ledger, Pri uses his insider expertise to decode a mystery that literally changed the operational protocols of an entire industry.
It's heavy stuff.
Very. We are examining Pri's lead case today, which is the unresolved 2001 assassination of Mike Amert. And I'll say the tone of Pri's findings is it's very cinematic, almost like a noir investigation. But every single detail we're about to review is documented forensic fact.
To really understand the gravity of what Pri uncovered, we have to start with the victim and the environment. So the year is 2001. The location is Woodinville, Washington. It's a highly affluent, heavily wooded suburb of Seattle. The region was still riding the wave of tech money back then.
Right, so lots of high-value transactions,
right.
Constant movement.
Precisely. And Mike Amert was a 40-year-old, top-producing real estate agent working for Windermere Real Estate.
And Pri's investigation highlights a fascinating paradox right at the start of the report. Because Amert wasn't some naive rookie who, you know, didn't know how to read a room.
Far from it.
Before he got his real estate license, Amert was actually a trained investigator with the King County Medical Examiner's Office.
That's the part that really caught me. He had professional experience dealing with violent crime. He was trained to observe environments critically, to look for things that were out of place.
Right. He had strict situational awareness.
Exactly. He was the absolute last person you would expect to walk blindly into an ambush.
Which is what makes this so terrifying. In behavioral science, there's this concept called the trust default. It's the idea that humans are naturally wired to default to social compliance rather than threat detection.
Yeah, we want to be polite.
Right. But Amert had training to override that. So I view his murder through the lens of, say, a seasoned cybersecurity expert falling for a highly sophisticated phishing scam.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
Because when the veteran security architect gets hacked, it doesn't mean they were foolish. It proves just how flawlessly the architecture of the trap was designed to bypass their specific defenses.
And the trap set for Mike Amert was a masterpiece of operational security. According to Pri's report, in early January 2001, Amert gets a phone call from a man identifying himself as Stephen Doe.
Stephen Doe.
Creative.
Right. Stephen claimed to be a wealthy buyer interested in viewing a specific, vacant, 4,000-square-foot luxury home on the market in Woodinville.
But the way Stephen set up this meeting is where Pri's analysis really shines. This wasn't just a standard phone call. This is not at all. Pri's investigation notes that the killer utilized a really complex series of disposable prepaid phone cards and unlisted numbers to establish contact.
And we have to contextualize this for 2001.
Yes, definitely.
Today, anyone can download an app, generate a burner phone number in 3 seconds, and be done with it.
But in 2001... obscuring your telecommunications required immense, tedious effort. You had to purchase physical calling cards with cash.
Right.
You'd travel to public payphones, dial toll-free routing numbers, punch in massive PIN codes just to obscure your origin point.
It's a highly calculated, exceptionally rare move for a standard criminal encounter.
Yeah.
I mean, the friction involved in doing that suggests a level of premeditation that goes way beyond a simple crime of opportunity.
It speaks to a chilling level of sophistication. The killer engineered an interaction that felt completely routine to a real estate agent.
A wealthy client wanting to see a luxury property.
Exactly, all while perfectly cloaking his own identity.
So Emert agrees to the showing. He drives out to this isolated property.
Yeah.
And he never comes home. When he misses his subsequent appointments, his family and colleagues immediately know something is terribly wrong. Eventually, the authorities enter the vacant house, and they find Emert in the master bathroom.
He had been severely beaten and stabbed multiple times.
It was a brutal, contained ambush. But the way Pree breaks down the crime scene analysis in his ledger reveals something unnervingly clinical, because detectives instantly ruled out the most common motive for a violent encounter in an empty home.
Which would be a robbery.
Right, because Emert's wallet, his luxury watch, and his cash were left completely untouched.
And what's fascinating here is that if a predator targets an isolated individual for financial gain, they take the valuables.
Always.
Even if an argument escalates into violence, a standard criminal will typically grab the cash before fleeing. Leaving those items in plain sight meant the violence wasn't the byproduct of a robbery.
The violence was the sole objective.
Exactly.
Wait, I want to challenge that logic for a second, though.
Okay.
If we assume this is a highly sophisticated, premeditated hit, wouldn't a truly smart hitman take the wallet specifically to throw the detectives off the scent?
Ah, I see what you're saying.
Like, if you want to mask an assassination, making it look like a tragic mugging seems like the most logical countermeasure. Why leave the cash behind and essentially broadcast that it was a targeted hit?
That is a brilliant question, and it really gets to the core of criminal operational security. See, faking a robbery actually introduces dangerous physical variables.
Oh, so?
If you take the wallet, you now possess the victim's physical property. If you're pulled over for a broken taillight pulling out of the neighborhood and the police see the victim's ID in your car...
Oh, you're caught.
You're caught. Hmm. If you try to use the credit cards to sell the illusion of a robbery, you leave a digital footprint. Camera footage. The safest play for a professional is to leave the scene as sterile as possible and walk away with absolutely nothing tying you to the victim.
Wow. And speaking of leaving a sterile scene, Pree uncovers another detail that proves how methodical this killer was, the forensic countermeasure.
This part is chilling.
Before leaving the house, the killer took the time to turn on the master bathroom faucets, deliberately partially submerging the crime scene in water.
And water is devastating to a forensic investigation. It initiates a process called hydrolysis, which rapidly breaks down the cellular material required to pull a clean DNA profile.
It washes away trace fibers from clothing.
It dilutes blood spatter, which ruins the impact angles detectives use to reconstruct the physical struggle.
So taking the time to calmly initiate a water-based countermeasure after committing a brutal murder, it just demonstrates a terrifying presence of mind.
It creates an absolute vacuum of evidence, and the vacuum of motive is just as baffling. Pree's files emphasize that Emert was deeply trusted.
Yeah, he had no known enemies, no hidden gambling debts, no illicit underworld dealings.
There was absolutely no reason for someone to go through the immense, highly sophisticated trouble of contracting a professional hit on a suburban real estate agent.
The methodology pointed entirely to a targeted, paid execution. But the victim profile pointed entirely to an ordinary, well-liked professional.
Those two realities could not be reconciled. And because of the killer's extreme discipline, that vacuum held for a very long time.
Pry refers to it as a 20-year cold front. For an entire decade, this case was a complete black hole. The water-based countermeasure at the house worked flawlessly. The killer left a virtually pristine environment behind.
But they made one microscopic mistake during the getaway. And it had to do with Emert's vehicle.
Right. After the murder, Emert's luxury SUV was stolen from the driveway. It was later found dumped at the Woodinville Town Center, which is a busy shopping plaza.
The killer used it to flee the isolated subdivision and blend back into a populated area.
And their discipline finally slipped when it came to their exit strategy. In 2011, 10 full years after the murder, forensic technology finally caught up to the evidence.
Yeah, investigators were able to extract a minute DNA profile from the steering wheel of Emert's abandoned SUV.
We're talking about touch DNA here.
Right. When someone grips a steering wheel, the friction leaves behind a microscopic amount of epithelial skin cells. In 2001, processing that infinitesimal amount of degraded cellular material was incredibly difficult.
Nearly impossible.
But by 2011, advancements in polymerase chain reaction, or PCR technology, allowed forensic scientists to amplify those tiny fragments into a complete genetic profile.
But having a profile only matters if you have someone to compare it to.
True.
So the DNA sits in the system, just waiting, until 2017. Finally, a database match identifies the ghost.
The profile was run through CODIS, the FBI's combined DNA index system, which aggregates genetic profiles from all these local, state, and federal agencies. And the system flagged a match belonging to a man named Gary Gene Krueger.
And Pry's report notes that Krueger's profile fit the forensic reality of the crime scene perfectly. He wasn't some desperate burglar.
No, he was a lifelong criminal. He had a heavily documented history of violence and was a suspected professional hitman who'd been implicated in multiple unsolved murders across the Pacific Northwest.
The operational security, the burner phone cards, the water countermeasure, it all aligned exactly with Krueger's known methodology.
But there is a massive complication to this breakthrough.
Yeah.
Krueger died in a drowning incident in 2010.
A full year before the touch DNA was even extracted from the steering wheel. And 7 years before the CODIS database match. The authorities found the weapon, but the weapon had already taken his secrets to the grave.
What Prey's investigation makes definitively clear, however, is that Krueger did not have a personal motive.
He had absolutely no connection, socially or professionally, to Mike Amert.
Krueger was a contractor. Someone paid him to clear that property or eliminate that agent.
Which brings us to an anomaly in Prey's case file that completely rewrites how you view the timeline. Prey uncovers a near miss that occurred just days before Amert's murder. The same caller, identifying himself as Steven, targeted a completely different real estate agent.
Mm.
In the ledger, Pry refers to him only as Jason.
Steven contacted Jason using the same obscured communication methods, the same string of calling cards, and asked to be shown the exact same 4,000-square-foot property in Woodinville.
The exact same trap.
Yeah.
But Jason survives. And Pry details that Jason survived because he adhered to a very strict personal boundary. It was a life-saving protocol that fought against that trust default we discussed earlier.
Jason flat-out refused to meet a new, unverified client at an isolated property without them first coming into his brokerage office to present a physical photo ID.
Which is huge, because sales professionals are under immense pressure to be accommodating.
Oh, constantly. The fear of losing a major commission often overrides basic safety instincts.
But Jason stood his ground. He prioritized security over hospitality. And because he set that boundary, the hitman aborted the mission.
Because Krueger could easily control an empty house, but he could not risk walking into a populated brokerage office full of witnesses, administrative staff, and security cameras to present a fake ID.
The physical variables were too high.
So he backed off.
And he pivoted to Mike Amert. I really want to sit with the psychological weight of that for a moment.
It's heavy.
When Jason found out what happened to Amert, the realization must have been utterly paralyzing. But Pree explores a deeply disturbing implication here.
Right.
Was the unknown mastermind targeting the physical property,
mm-hmm.
meaning any agent who opened the door would suffice? Or were they strictly targeting Mike Emmert and Jason was just a dry run for the killer to test the location's vulnerabilities and layout?
It is the darkest unresolved question in the ledger. Was Emmert the specific intended target of an assassination? Or was he simply the unlucky professional who agreed to facilitate access to a trap meant for someone else?
Right. Did a mastermind want any agent dead to legally stall a commercial development? Or maybe send a violent message to a specific investment firm? Or manipulate a regional transaction?
Because Krueger's operational security was so tight, and because he's dead, we still do not definitively know the why.
This brings us to the bottom line of the investigation. Priyanshu Adithakar's final verdict for his fellow realtors, for hotel consultants, and for commercial investors. Priyan identifies this systemic flaw as the vulnerability of the open door.
It's the terrifying reality that the fundamental mechanics of the real estate industry require professionals to operate as public targets.
It's a massive structural flaw in the way business has historically been conducted, prioritizing the frictionless experience of the client over the physical security of the agent.
And the tragedy of Mike Emmert forced a severe pivot. Pree details how the Washington State Department of Licensing and the wider real estate community had to completely rewrite their operational blueprints.
Today, these protocols are informally known in the industry as the Mike Emmert Rule.
And Pree, reporting from his dual vantage point as both an advisor and an active agent on the ground, outlines exactly how these modern safeguards function.
Let's break those down.
First and foremost is the office first rule. This is the formal institutionalization of the boundary that saved Jason's life.
It mandates that all new, unverified clients must meet at a secure, monitored brokerage office or a populated public space to digitally copy their government-issued ID before any property tours occur.
It strips away the anonymity that predators fundamentally rely on. Then, Pry analyzes the technological infrastructure that's been built to support this. We're talking about applications like Forewarn.
And this is just a simple Google search.
No, not at all. Forewarn uses API integrations with public records, criminal databases, and property registries to allow an agent to run an instant, comprehensive background check using nothing more than an incoming phone number.
It verifies identity before the meeting ever takes place.
We also see the implementation of systems like CenterKey for property access. Instead of a standard combination lockbox, CenterKey requires an authenticated app to open the door.
It creates an immutable digital footprint, leveraging Bluetooth timestamps to record exactly who accessed the lockbox and at what exact second.
It eliminates the vacuum of evidence. Along with GPS tracking distress codes and the TWS company buddy system, where agents bring a mortgage partner to isolated showings, the industry has systematically introduced variables that a predator cannot control.
So why does Pry's ledger matter to you if you have absolutely nothing to do with commercial real estate?
Because this case is fundamentally about the inherent danger of routine trust in any business transaction.
Exactly. We all operate within our own versions of the trust default. Whether you're an independent contractor meeting a new client in a rented co-working space,
or a gig economy worker delivering to an unlit residence,
or simply selling a piece of furniture on an online marketplace, you are engaging with unverified variables.
Pry's findings highlight the absolute necessity of establishing strict vetting protocols, regardless of what industry you operate in.
You cannot allow the economic pressure of closing a deal or securing a contract to override your situational awareness.
Pry's investigation concludes with a sobering reality. While the forensic science finally identified the hand holding the knife as Gary Jean Kruger, the mind that financed the operation remains entirely hidden in the shadows.
The case is only partially resolved.
Kruger was a professional asset. He was a weapon pointed at a target.
But the individual who paid for that weapon, the mastermind who engineered the trap and benefited from Immert's death, has never been caught.
Which means the architect of this crime is still out there.
And that leaves us with a deeply unsettling final thought to consider. We just spent this deep dive exploring how the real estate industry spent 20 years building modern safeguards.
The office first rule, ID verification, systems like Forewarn.
All based on confirming someone's digital and physical identity. But if a predator in 2001 could bypass the defenses of a trained investigator using just a handful of physical calling cards, what happens tomorrow?
Oh, wow.
We are rapidly entering an era of sophisticated AI voice cloning and deepfake identification. What happens when the person booking an isolated property over the phone sounds exactly like a verified executive, complete with a digitally generated driver's license that passes a preliminary background check?
That's terrifying.
The modern safeguards Pry relies on might just be solving a 2001 problem.
Yeah.
It forces us to ask, as technology evolves to perfectly mimic reality, how do you verify the person on the other side of the door isn't just a flawless digital lure, leaving your business wide open for a 2026 predator?